Okay, raise your hand if you know the answer to this one. What do eggs and new cars and suits and, oh, I don't know, furniture have in common, huh? Three guesses, the first two don't count. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, 12 January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Look, if you actually needed three guesses to answer that question, well, clearly I haven't been doing my job because inflation, if I needed to say it, prices of all four of those things up, and inflation, as you've heard already, overall hit 7% December this year over December last. But, let us look month to month. Inflation was 0.5% in December, which was better than November, which was better than October. Do we dare ask then whether we're finally topping out? Oh, we do dare. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
There are reasons to think monthly inflation may have already maxed out.
We are seeing some deceleration.
Alan Dettmeister is an economist with UBS. Deceleration is in prices are still rising, just not as fast as they were. Flight and lodging prices might actually come down briefly because of Omicron dragging down demand. Car prices, economists say, are set to come off their completely insane highs as production starts to come back. Other goods seem to be cooling off too.
You know, energy, food prices, futures prices are suggesting that oil has kind of reached its peak.
But Dettmeister says core inflation, basically everything else, is not slowing down yet. And we are probably going to see another few months of eye-popping 7% annual inflation before it does come down, says Larry Summers, an economist at Harvard and former Treasury Secretary.
I don't see anything that changes the basic fact that we have an increasingly entrenched inflation problem.
Basically, all the transitory drivers of inflation may be falling away, leaving us with bigger problems.
The most fundamental factors driving what we're seeing are pervasive labor shortage, pushing up wages, which are the most fundamental labor costs, and what's happening in the housing market.
But economists disagree on how persistent all these drivers will be. Joe Gagnon is a fellow at the Peterson Institute.
The optimistic view is that Omicron will tear through the population very quickly. It will be mild and will come out sort of in a better place as far as the pandemic goes by March. And people might actually be more willing to go back into the labor force.
And that might keep labor costs under control. Of course, it would also trim wage growth. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Oh, yeah. Wages. We also learned today that average hourly pay was up 0.1% in December. That is real wages, meaning they were up even when you factor in the higher prices that Spree was just talking about. That said, we are also talking average here, and not everybody's pay is rising high enough to cover those higher costs. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains what's going on there.
Whether you've gotten a raise lately depends a lot on where you fall on the income spectrum.
Lower wage workers are seeing larger percentage increases than higher wage workers.
That's Lizanne Saunders, chief investment strategist at Charles Schwab, a current Marketplace underwriter. She says it also depends on what you do. Take leisure and hospitality, for instance.
Leisure and hospitality has, in general, seen the biggest increases in wages.
And those workers have been making enough to outpace inflation, says Sarah House, senior economist with Wells Fargo. But she says there are plenty of other industries where pay hasn't kept up with prices.
Areas like information, mining industry, manufacturing, construction.
One way workers have been able to beat inflation, House says, is by quitting their jobs and taking on new, higher paid roles elsewhere.
And so companies across the pay spectrum are really having to think about their compensation plans in terms of attracting new employees, but also keeping their existing ones.
As a result, those higher wages are likely to stick around, says economist Daniel Zhao at the job website Glassdoor.
Most employers would actually even prefer to furlough or lay off workers rather than cut pay because they know it would have a dramatic impact on employee morale.
But Zhao says it's not enough for pay to stay where it is. He says wages will have to keep rising as prices continue to grow. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, ain't nobody was surprised by that inflation report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. At the close in New York today, the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate, that'd be oil, was up almost 2%, just shy of $83 a barrel. And that historically would have had oil producers scrambling to drill. As we know, though, crude's a boom and bust business, and the people in it know that as well. As Marketplace's Andy Euler reminds us, any bump in oil and gas is welcome news for the economy of Midland, Texas, and the rest of the petroleum-rich Permian Basin.
The unemployment rate in Midland is 4.5%, down from 6.7% over the summer, thanks in no small part to more activity in the oil fields. Grant Swartzwelder, president of OTA Compression and Environmental and Oil Field Services firm in the area, says there are jobs to be filled, but the tight labor market is making it tough to do so.
When Whataburger will pay $15 an hour just to flip burgers, you know, that trickles all the way through to mechanics.
But he says it's not fast food restaurants he's worried about. Big oil companies poach his workers with higher pay. Swartzwelder's been in the industry here for 37 years and says in the past, when oil was 80 bucks a barrel, people migrated here for work.
In boom times, you would see license plates from all over the 50 states here in Midland. And you're not seeing that.
He says right now, if locals don't want the jobs, most aren't getting filled.
Whether folks are just tired of the bust boom cycles and just saying, you know, I don't need that extra money. I'll just stay put.
The U.S. is also trying to slowly wean itself off of fossil fuels, so oil and gas jobs could be short-lived. But Garrett Golding at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas says people can't just transition to green energy jobs overnight.
It's hard to see how the workers that are out there doing that type of work are just going to drop down everything and go work in the renewable sector. It's not really that simple at all.
And a transition away from oil and gas tax revenue wouldn't be simple either. James Beecham runs the Midland-Odessa Transportation Alliance.
Nearly about anybody out here is going to be over 50% of their tax base is solely going to be minerals.
He says those mineral leases pay for not only local needs, but contribute a big chunk of cash to the state budget as well. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The turn to this next story goes like this: from jobs in the energy economy to the energy required for jobs in the creative economy. Atiyah Jones is a visual artist. She's in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And back in the early months of this pandemic, she put her energy into making face masks. She talked about that with us back in July of 2020. And in the months and year or something since, her career has taken another turn.
So at the top of the pandemic, I was working a part-time job for the sole purpose of making money. This was not a dream-fulfilling position in any manner. And I did not feel the need to re-enter the workforce with that particular job when work became available because it didn't feel safe to me, which is a part of, you know, where being a mask producer was beneficial for me. But at some point, I distinctly remember missing myself. I missed making art that was not for sale, just art that I needed to get out of my body. And so I applied for a grant asking candidates to identify an issue that they became aware of throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. And an issue that I feel I have always run into professionally is not having time. My work is deeply inspired by the things I see, the absence of Black people when I travel sometimes. You know, these are all things that I don't have access to unless I have access to travel, unless I have access to just go for long walks. That is a luxury for me. And so what we created was a fellowship program, essentially, in which two artists would receive financial support in order to maintain their life. It isn't a project-based fellowship. It is more so related to the gap year and certain points of privilege that a lot of queer and BIPOC creatives do not have, with a kind of unbridled use of funding. We identified time as the luxury, as the time as the grant. This stipend equates to a $15 an hour job, 40 hours a week. It's not that much money. But in my time within my fellowship, I have learned how to drive. I went to meet my sister in Jamaica, which is a place that she truly loves. And now we hope that we can provide another opportunity for two marginalized artists to spend some time with themselves in whatever way suits their creative needs. I got back in the studio, and the things that I make right now are kind of fun. I have a better time in creating. And as I'm experiencing my own self-led fellowship, I'm also trying to find ways to make it a reality for someone else.
Atiyah Jones, she's in Pittsburgh, PA. That fellowship, by the way, that she was talking about is funded by Arts Equity Reimagined and the Kelly Strayhorn Theater. It's called Time Sensitive. Coming up.
For the first time, I hear the word alimony.
That'd get your attention, I bet, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 38 points today, a tenth percent, 36,290. The NASDAQ gained 34 points, about two-tenths percent, 15,188. The S&P 500 up 13, also two-tenths percent, 47.26. Just Eat up 3.6% today. Grubhub's parent company maintained its 2022 forecast, said it was seeing a rise in orders. Rival food delivery firm DoorDash shed 2% despite an upgrade from analysts. There's new national survey by the National PTA that looks at parents' expectations and concerns around the virus. 48% of parents said they'd been told their child could have been exposed to the virus at some point in the current school year. Back in November, 70% of parents felt, quote, at least somewhat comfortable having their children attend school in person. Bond prices steady from yesterday, 10 years at 1.74%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. If we are going to get anywhere close to net zero greenhouse gas emissions in this economy and on this planet, to be honest, we're going to have to replace fossil fuels with renewables. Zero carbon, non-polluting, replenishable power sources. Wind, solar, and geothermal. And we're going to need better batteries, too. Way better batteries. Also, we are probably going to have to consider nukes. I know. Nuclear power comes with some baggage. And we're probably not going to build a whole lot of big new nuclear power plants, given the baggage and the cost and the construction delays they have historically had. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, new, smaller nuclear plants could be deployed later on in this decade.
NuScale Power, a firm based in Portland, Oregon, is promoting small modular nuclear reactors. The company plans to get full approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to build and fire up its first nuclear plant at a site in Idaho by the end of this decade.
NuScale's scalable design, a power plant can house up to 12 individual power modules, offers the benefits of carbon-free energy.
The company is one of several developing small modular nuclear plants, and it's somewhat ahead of the pack, having received design approval from the NRC for one of its models that uses the industry-standard light water as a coolant. Chris Colbert, NuScale's chief strategy officer, says a plant can be sited on just 35 acres near a city or big manufacturing facility,
eliminating about two-thirds of the systems and components that are required for safety in a typical large reactor.
The plant would be compact, built in a factory, and shipped ready to produce power. And to do so safely, says Colbert.
In the event of a station blackout, such as was experienced at Fukushima, we can safely shut down our plants and our modules without any operator action, without any AC or DC power, and without any additional water.
Nuclear waste would be stored in dry casks on site, just like at existing nuclear plants, says Colbert, and protected from release, theft, or sabotage. NuScale still faces major obstacles going forward, says Alexandra Klass at the University of Minnesota Law School.
It is significant to get the design approved, but there's still a long way to go in the permitting process. There'll be appeals, there might be litigation.
Still, Jonathan Lesser at the Manhattan Institute says new nuclear is necessary and should be fast-tracked by regulators to eliminate carbon emissions.
Folks who think it can be achieved solely with wind and solar and battery storage backup are frankly deluding themselves. It's physically impossible.
Advocates for renewables who oppose nuclear power debate that proposition. And so far, climate change-minded investors haven't exactly embraced the nuclear option.
You don't find many clean energy indexes or folks who are tracking the clean energy sector that currently include nuclear. You just don't see a lot of that.
Ron Pernick is co-founder of Clean Edge, which develops clean energy stock indexes.
What point would we consider next generation nuclear technology a clean energy solution? Can they address nuclear proliferation, nuclear waste concerns? Can they address safety? And that's still an open question.
I put that question to Chris Colbert at NuScale.
My response to that is, quite honestly, nuclear energy is carbon-free energy, full stop.
Now, NuScale is closer to commercial deployment than rival developers using more novel technology than light water, like liquid metal, salts, or pressurized gas to cool their small reactors. But a lot remains unknown about how NuScale's reactors would actually perform in the field, says Edwin Lyman at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
The design itself does have novel features, which are in large part untested. So I think there are some technical uncertainties, and there are also financial uncertainties, which raise questions about when this reactor is actually going to be deployed.
NuScale recently announced it's planning to go public later this year and is hoping to raise several hundred million dollars to support that final drive to commercial operation. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Permanent alimony, payment for life from one spouse to another after a divorce, has been around for centuries. Really, the first written record of the idea is from the Babylonians in 1750 BC, designed to prevent women from falling into poverty after a divorce and designed to last forever. The world has, of course, changed just a bit since Babylonian times, and now, in most cases, alimony ends eventually. There are, though, some states where permanent alimony is still the law, Florida among them. There was a fight there last year to try to end it, one of many such attempts over the years. Marketplace's Rima Kreis, the host of our podcast, This Is Uncomfortable, has this story of one woman who took part in that fight.
When Sonia Delgado was just 14 years old, she found herself pregnant. She'd grown up in a conservative family in Puerto Rico, and to protect their reputation, she and her boyfriend got married.
I should have been getting ready for my quinceañera party. Instead, I was wearing a wedding dress.
She and her husband eventually had three kids together, and money was a constant issue.
I fought about money almost all my life with him. Everything was a fight.
They'd slipped into chronic debt. Sonia's husband had a hard time holding down a job. And over the years, Sonia eventually became the family's breadwinner. But the thing is, she had almost no control of their money. It went straight into a joint account, and her husband made all their financial decisions. After about 30 years of marriage and fighting over money nearly every day, Sonia had had enough. She filed for divorce.
So it wasn't until then, for the first time, I hear the word alimony.
Most divorces don't involve alimony at all. But if you make more money than your spouse in a marriage, you can be legally obligated to support them financially for some period of time after a divorce. When it came time to settle on the terms of their divorce, Sonia found out that her ex-husband was asking for $800 a month.
I almost fall off that chair, really. I was in shock. I said, but how could this be if I barely make any living? And it was permanently, meaning for life.
At that time, Sonia earned about $42,000 a year as a high school Spanish teacher. The alimony would amount to nearly a third of her take-home pay. Her ex was recently on disability and out of work. She had a salary. And even though it was a modest one, it was a lot more than what he had.
I tell my lawyer, there's no way I can pay him $800. I don't have that kind of money.
Sonia and her ex went back and forth until he finally said, okay, let's lower it to $600 a month. Not long after, Sonia sat down at her kitchen table to write the first of a never-ending pile of alimony checks. She sealed the envelope and dropped it in the mailbox. When you made that first payment, what did it feel like in your body?
It felt like I've been just beaten up with a bat. It was just like an insult. I was so humiliated that I had to do that.
For Sonia, the alimony fuels this old bitterness, makes it almost impossible to move on. And it's not just her own situation she's mad about. She doesn't think anybody should be getting alimony for life.
Why do I have to pay another adult past the age of 18? And this adult has nothing to do with me anymore. Why you just make us hate each other even more?
We contacted Sonia's ex multiple times and weren't able to reach him. But both Sonia and her son say he's still on disability and doesn't work. It wasn't until about 5 years after her divorce that Sonia tried to take matters into her own hands. She connected with other permanent alimony payers, pushing for legislation to change Florida's alimony laws. And in October of 2017, she drove to Tallahassee to testify in support of a bill that would keep short-term alimony intact, but would put an end to permanent alimony.
Public testimony.
Here she is talking in front of a group of lawmakers.
As a teenager, I was faced with an unintended pregnancy, which unfortunately misled me to marry the father of my child at a very young age.
This wasn't the first time this fight was being waged in Florida. Two similar bills to end permanent alimony actually passed the Florida State House and Senate in 2013 and in 2016, but the governor ended up vetoing both bills. This time around, the bill Sonia was fighting for, it didn't even get put on the calendar for a vote. What did it feel like when that bill failed?
Oh, so frustrating. So frustrating and disappointed. It shouldn't be so complicated, but it is.
Many alimony recipients argue they need this financial support, though, especially if they were the ones in the marriage doing a lot of the unpaid labor, you know, maybe taking care of the kids, cooking, cleaning. Maybe they intentionally made sacrifices to their own career so their partner could be the breadwinner. More and more men are the ones receiving alimony, but women are still the primary alimony recipients. And Sonny gets that it can be hard for many of them to re-enter the workforce, but she still draws a hard line.
I believe that a woman living under those circumstances where she's being 100% supported, I believe there should be some transition pay so that she can get her business in order. But it shouldn't be lasting forever.
But for now, the fight to end permanent alimony in Florida remains as long-lasting as the alimony payments themselves. I'm Rima Reis for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, just because we talked about it a little bit earlier this week, the mess the Internal Revenue Service is in. The National Taxpayer Advocate, kind of like their ombudsman, I guess, was out with a report today. As of the end of last year, she says, the IRS's backlog was 6 million paper individual returns, more than 2 million amended individual returns, and about 5 million items of taxpayer correspondence. So, file early, right? Okay, we're out of here, but not without your moment of economic context, an oldie but an Omicron-inspired goodie, I think. Daily Transportation Security Administration throughput. For yesterday, just a hair over 1.1 million people went through airport checkpoints. That's below the recent trend by about a half million or so. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Dario Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Tirado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.